Alien technology. Amazing work by William Henry, as he collaborated, of course, with Dr. Edgar Mitchell and got some information on just what he was working on with results with extraterrestrials. Amazing story, and so much more. William Henry with us next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. William Henry is an investigative mythologist. He's an author of numerous books, including the one we're going to talk about tonight, in addition to so many other things. He's just constantly working. He applies his theories in science and consciousness to ancient myths and hopes to uncover these secrets that are guarded by such groups. Several years ago, you might remember, William was in Egypt during the Arab Spring on a bus talking to me on Coast to Coast, right in the middle of all that mess. William, I'm so glad that you got out of that thing.
That was incredible, George. I mean, what a memory. And you really did. You pulled us through. Just hearing your voice and knowing there was all those Coast listeners out there cheering us on, rooting for us, made all the difference.
How have you been? What's new with you and Claire and everybody else?
Yeah, everything's good. Just been super busy trying to get some projects wound up here at the end of the year and looking forward to turning the page.
Can you believe how fast this year has gone?
Oh, I can't even. I mean, it seems like we just took the Christmas lights down last week, and now here we are, 2017, staring us in the face. Incredible.
Well, I got to tell you, is there anything we can do, William, to slow down that clock?
Well, we can just meditate. That's it. Just try to go into the zone and stay there.
All right, let's talk about some of your work lately, what you've been up to. We're going to get into some amazing stories, some of your newer works and everything else. But tell me about this strange story with Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Yeah, what a shock. I mean, back early October, like everybody else, I'm glued to the WikiLeaks dumps of John Podesta. Of course, he's the ultimate Democratic power broker, Beltway insider. He was the fixer for Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, chief of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and he's also perhaps the number one UFO disclosure advocate in the U.S. government and has been for a couple of decades. And so there's emails that are written by a representative of Dr. Mitchell. Her name is Terry Mansfield, and she's urgently requesting a meeting between Dr. Mitchell and John Podesta, because as it turns out, Dr. Mitchell has been working with extraterrestrial intelligences about disclosure, and it turns out that these ETIs, as he refers to them, have a free energy device, a zero-point energy device that they want to bring to humanity to solve all our energy problems, bring world peace, salvation of the human race, the whole works. I mean, there's a lot on the line here. And as I'm probing deeper into these WikiLeaks, this WikiLeaks dump, I soon see that Dr. Mitchell refers to these ETIs as directly obedient to God. They come from a contiguous universe, he said, meaning a neighboring universe. And I'm reading this, I'm saying, wait a minute, this is exactly what I was researching back in 2012 in my book, The Judgment Day Device.
Wow.
Where I revealed that all the world's, the big three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all have prophecies about the appearance of a messianic or a Christ figure during an end time or judgment day scenario. And what most people don't realize is that those prophecies also describe this figure bringing forth a device, a tool, an instrument that comes from the heavenly realms that will have a dramatic impact on human consciousness. And as I'm reading this WikiLeaks dump, I'm thinking, this is the same device. Dr. Mitchell is working on this Judgment Day device, as I called it, and he must be working with the ETI that he's describing have to be the angels that I've been documenting is working with this device for almost 3,000 years or more.
Jeez, that's an amazing story. Now, for some people who are brand new to the program, they may not know who Dr. Mitchell is or was. Dr. Mitchell just passed away, but he was Apollo 14 astronaut, walked on the moon. William knows him. I've known him. I've known him, William, when he was living, to be a great guy, no nonsense. I don't think he embellished things. So this story adds even more credibility from the fact that it was him right in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what was so mind-blowing to me, George. I had no idea that he was working on this on this device or with this class of beings that, again, I had been documenting as trying to bring this device to Earth for 3,500 years or more. And now it is actually at the center of all of the events that are presently unfolding in the Middle East in terms of prophecy, where people are maneuvering to get control of various sacred sites throughout Syria, throughout Iraq, elsewhere, Israel, all in preparation for what they believe is going to be an unfolding end-time scenario.
Wow, incredible work. Now, I'm also fascinated in the fact that the extraterrestrial intelligence who are obedient to God. Tell me more about that.
Well, that was the tip-off for me because in my research, and I've been researching extraterrestrials, angels, and otherworldly intelligences for over 20 years, there is only one class of beings that we know of in the literature, in the sacred literature, that refer to themselves as directly obedient to God. And they are the seraphim angels. They're the highest order of angels. They're beings that some believe were actually at one time humans who were transformed into angels and now serve at the throne of God. They're kind of like God's right hand angels, if you will. They're considered to be beings of pure light and pure love, but they can take on human manifestation. They can phase out of the heavenly dimension or vibration, if you will, take on earthly incarnation and influence human affairs. And throughout time, they are constantly associated with a collection of symbols that actually, when it's assembled together, forms a device of tremendous power. It's a consciousness device. It can open gateways in space. It can transform humans from flesh and blood into celestial flesh or light beings. It has super phenomenal super physics capabilities. And this is why I believe this is actually the same device that Dr. Mitchell was working on.
Now, these beings who are obedient to God that are on the top of the chain, let's also talk about the Nephilim for a moment, William, because they're in this batch somehow, but they aren't way up at the top, are they?
No, the story is that these seraphim originally dwelled at the throne of God, and they had a specific type of body. They did not have flesh and blood bodies. They had more eternal bodies. Our flesh and blood bodies are ephemeral. They're temporary. They're fragile. They're not meant for any other location in the universe other than planet Earth. And this is why we're having so many problems with putting humans in space, because the human body is not meant to leave the Earth. But the bodies of the seraphim angels, they come from the heavenly realms, and they have bodies that are capable of phasing from the celestial flesh or their light being status into earthly flesh and blood bodies. Technically speaking, they are the fallen angels that were referred to in the book of Genesis and elsewhere, in the Essene literature about the watcher angels as well. When we talk about fallen angels, people automatically want to think that the term fallen means they're somehow evil, demonic, or something of that nature. But actually, when you get into the literature about the fallen angels, at least from the academic perspective that I've been studying it from, you realize that fallen simply means they are not in their celestial flesh bodies. Fallen means they are in their earthly bodies. And when they came into the earthly realm, they were able then to mate with the daughters of men, as the book of Genesis tells us, and they had offspring. That's the Nephilim. The Nephilim are the children, if you will, of these seraphim angels and earthly human beings.
What does it mean to be called seraphim?
The term seraphim actually means the burning ones or the winged serpents. There's a couple of alternative definitions. Why are they called the burning ones? They're called the burning ones because they are believed to burn with the love of the Creator. When you see the seraphim portrayed in Judeo-Christian art, they're bright red beings, often with feathers that are tinged with orange to indicate they're burning, or the idea that they're somehow luminous. Their bodies are vortex-shaped, indicating that they're spinning or super high-frequency beings. They're also described as humanoid. In fact, it's very interesting when you look at the complete physical profile of the seraphim as provided in the various eyewitness descriptions from Isaiah, from Ezekiel. Even St. Francis of Assisi encountered the resurrected Jesus as a seraphim. This is because the body of the seraphim is the same as the resurrection body of Jesus. So when he turned his body into light at the resurrection and ascension, he effectively, according to St. Francis of Assisi, became a seraph or a member of the seraphim, this class of angels. And they, again, they're humanoid, luminous. They often are portrayed wearing rainbow-colored cloaks. They have the ability to phase in and out of our existence practically in a blink of an eye. In every way, shape, and form, they are perhaps the most advanced beings that we can imagine in our present state of consciousness development.
How do they show up? In a craft or just individually?
Just individually. There's no mention of a UFO-type spacecraft when we're talking about appearances of the seraphim. I actually had an encounter with one time.
You did?
It was 2012. I was up at James Gilliland's East SETI Ranch,
mm-hmm.
and I was talking about the seraphim. You had several hundred people there, and I'm giving a presentation about the seraphim. And afterward, James Gilliland says, "Well, at 9 o'clock, we're going to open up a portal, and we're going to bring a seraphim in." And everybody kind of laughed, including me. And so, sure enough, 9 o'clock, he does a kind of a meditation type of a ceremony. We step outside, and there must have been 30, 40 of us. We look up into the sky, and here comes this bright orange ball of light. It appeared to be maybe 100 feet, 150 feet in the air above us. And we look up. It's strangely silent. And you start going through the checklist. There's no noise, so it's not a helicopter. It's not an airplane. It's moving very slow, and it's coming right towards us. And it's then that I realized that this had to be a seraphim. And what is so fascinating about this, George, is that somebody had the presence of mind to pull out a video camera and videotaped it. And while we couldn't see the detail of this bright orange orb of light coming down, the reaction of the people that saw it told the story. And it was sheer joy, absolute euphoria. And this is exactly what you see in the ancient literature of the descriptions of the appearance of the seraphim, that they bring this tremendous state of instant love, joy, and just exaltation, really. I mean, it puts you at a whole other level of vibration. It was absolutely amazing.
And they've been coming here from at least, what, 3,500 B.C.?
At least. I mean, they are considered to be the oldest extraterrestrial representatives that have been coming to Earth. And you can easily make an argument, as some Sumerian scholars do. Dr. Mike Heiser, for example, equates the seraphim and the watchers with the Anunnaki.
Now that's an interesting take. Did Zechariah ever talk about that? Now, he thought they were more spacefaring, right? The Anunnaki?
He thought they were more spacefaring, going through the cosmos and chemical rockets and this kind of thing, which is fine. But when you look at it more from, again, sort of an academic level, you realize that the scholars have been looking at this question for a very long time. They just don't use the same terminology as some of the popularizers of this work. But there's no question that the watcher angels are seraphim, and the watchers and the Anunnaki are equated. They're the same.
Did they genetically alter whatever species might have been on the planet at the time, and here we are?
Yeah, I believe that they did, and this is something I've been tracking in my books, at least around a 5,000-year timeline, probably older, of stories that originate probably many thousands of years ago, but were committed to papyrus or tablets within the past 5,000 years, that tell of these beings coming to Earth influencing human affairs most directly by tweaking our DNA. The story of Ptah, for example, in ancient Egypt, the ancient Egyptians clearly say that this god Ptah, who came from Sirius, was the god who fashioned the bodies of men. His hieroglyph has a double helix within it. So that tells me that he is definitely involved in some kind of genetic alteration of humanity. The ultimate purpose, according to the Egyptians, was for the human body to be a more conducive vehicle for the ascension of the soul. And that's something that the seraphim are deeply interested in as well, is influencing human consciousness and also ultimately our bodies to make our body a more conducive vehicle, a ladder or stairway, if you will, for the soul to return to its source.
Now tell us a little bit more, William, about this free energy perpetual motion machine. Exactly what is it and how does it work?
Well, that's the ultimate question. Dr. Mitchell believed that zero-point energy is the ultimate energy source from which all matter derives. So he believes that it's everywhere present in the universe, and ultimately it's not widely understood in physics, but we are beginning to recognize the consciousness component of any kind of zero-point energy device. And this is something that was another tip-off that my research was running parallel to Dr. Mitchell's and others, is that when we look back at the seraphim and the depictions of them bringing a device to Earth, there's always this consciousness component. They were emphatic that in order for humanity to raise itself above the level of its present existence, to climb the ladder of ascension, if you will, it was going to require an expansion of our consciousness. And in the stories, for example, the Ark of the Covenant, of course, is part, one component of this overall zero-point energy device. And when Bezalel, who is the Israelite craftsman, just before he made the Ark of the Covenant, God gave to him, downloaded, if you will, all the wisdom of the universe. Now the question is, why would God do that if Bezalel was making a simple golden box? The answer is that this was far more profound a device, the Ark of the Covenant was, than previously realized, and that, in fact, there's a major consciousness component to this. We've got to begin to think like the angels in order to make these zero-point energy devices go.
This is a remarkable story, William. It truly is. Except it's free energy, and you know they're going to battle to get to not let us have this technology.
Well, that's why it's at the centerpiece now of all these prophecies, too, because, and this is something I concluded in my 2012 book, The Judgment Day Device, is that, yes, there are all these prophecies from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam about the recovery and return of this device as actually the sign and symbol or seal, if you will, of the Christ Messiah or Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi. But once this device is brought to the world, it's the game changer. It completely obliterates the existing world order and puts us on a new footing as a species, both in terms of our consciousness and also as a species in terms of its development. We're no longer going to be a type zero civilization on the Kardashev scale. We now become a type one, type two, or possibly even type three, where we can harness the power of our planet, harness the power of our star, harness the power of our universe, and then finally becoming a species capable of colonizing our solar system and beyond.
William's latest book is called The Skingularity Is Near. We're going to have him explain that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Artificial intelligence technology. Some time ago, William wrote a book called The Skingularity Is Near, talking about the state of artificial intelligence. As a matter of fact, he gave out some copies of the book, and people went crazy. How many copies got taken, William?
It's over 10,000 now. People requested free copies of it. They're just absolutely alarmed by what is happening in the technological sphere, and they want to arm themselves with knowledge about how to navigate what's coming.
Is it scary what's happening right now?
It's horrifying, actually, because what's on the line here ultimately is human free will and the individual's choice to choose how they live their life. I mean, there seems to be an effort on the part of the Sultans of Silicon Valley to want to take over all aspects of our lives, and artificial intelligence is the Trojan horse, if you will, that they're using to infiltrate our lives. And it won't be long if we allow this to continue before people will realize that we just simply are smart things on the Internet of Things, or Internet of Everything, as the Silicon Valley types talk it. And by smart, I don't mean they want us to be more intelligent. They want us to be more controllable, more manageable, more programmable.
Did you invent that word, singularity?
I did, yeah. Singularity is, of course, it's a play on Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity.
Yep,
Ray Kurzweil,
exactly,
is Google's technology guru. He's the one that's driving their quest for immortality and life extension and so forth.
Is this push to accept transhumanism too much?
Well, I think it is. It's too much too fast. There's not enough public discussion about all the various implications of it. I mean, the idea that we're going to suddenly go from humans to humans packed with technology is appealing to some people. I mean, I'm certainly an advocate for human potential, but especially human spiritual potential. And I get a little bit alarmed when you've got the major corporations in the world, Apple, Google, Samsung, GE, all aiming their technology at the human body and believing that it's almost their right to be able to transform the human body to suit their needs rather than to suit the needs of the spirit or the soul.
Where do we stand right now, William, with artificial intelligence? What's happening out there?
Well, you've got rapid development. You've got hundreds of billions of dollars going into the development of these networks. People are starting to really adapt to the early Trojan horse devices, the Alexa devices. Siri are the front door, if you will, of artificial intelligence in our daily lives. And people are starting to early adapt that. It's becoming very popular, but what they don't realize is that is just the very beginning of what's to come. And within the next couple of years here, we're going to see more and more adaption of artificial intelligence in our daily life. How many times do you call customer service? When was the last time you talked with a human being when you called customer service?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, you go through a litany of push buttons of you know, some recorded voice to get to where you wanted to go, and then they put you on hold for 20 minutes.
Exactly, and the acceleration is just absolutely dramatic. However, the transhumanist agenda is slowed down at the moment because of the populist uprising, the earthquakes around the world, in Britain, U.S., Italy. People are rejecting the globalist agenda, and the only way that the globalist agenda works, and that the globalist agenda, by the way, is UN 2030, where they seek to eliminate all national borders. No borders, no religion, ultimately no gender is part of this plan, where we're just simply a unified race. You will no longer identify yourself as an American or an Italian or a Brit. You will identify yourself simply as an earthling. And the only way that this globalist agenda works is with transhumanism, with technology. This is why Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook and others that promote this globalist agenda seek to put a smartphone in every single human being's hand by 2030, so that every single human being on the planet is online together by 2030. And most of these people, there's about 4.5 billion, 5 billion people that still don't have smartphones. But those are the same people that don't have a toilet or clean water either. But for some reason, the globalist agenda says it's more important for us to put a smartphone in your hand than it is for you to have sanitation.
Yeah. And food or something like that.
Exactly. So these populist uprisings, these earthquakes, have slowed it down because people are saying, wait a minute, no, we're not ready to get rid of America. Yeah, we still want to be Brits, and the Italians are saying we want our nationalistic identity. I think that what's behind all this is this, maybe it's still unconscious, but this creeping sensation that the technology is moving in and we're losing control of our lives. And this is what's driving this, these populist uprisings to say, wait a minute, no, we want to maintain things the way they were, the good old days, which never existed either, right? But at least people are saying, no, we're not moving forward with this agenda because we want to keep our borders, we want to keep our genders, we want to keep our religion, at least for now. And I'm certainly an advocate of the kind of the new agey idea of the human race, but it's the practical steps that get us there that people aren't really being educated on. And at the highest level, the elite are just simply thinking they can work the gears of civilization and everyone's going to follow. But I think what they got was a wake-up call to realize that there's a lot of people out there that aren't ready to take their chip. And well, they might not be ready for a good while.
William Henry, our guest. Of course, we'll take calls with William next hour. His website, williamhenry.net. Any more trips coming up for you?
Well, headed to Egypt in February.
You're going back again, huh?
Yep. This will be my 17th trip to Egypt.
Jeez.
And taking a group. I've still got some spaces available. If anybody wants to join us, please visit my website, williamhenry.net. We'd love to have you join us. I'm very excited about it. Lots of new things in Egypt. I mean, the hidden chambers in the pyramid, soon to be revealed, I'm sure. They're hinting at that. They're opening tombs to the public that haven't been opened for a while, Nefertari and Seti, for example. So the Egyptians are really excited. The U.S. government proclaimed Egypt a safe place to travel for tourists, or among the safest places for tourists to travel. And so Egypt's been booming the past several years, and now they're looking for the tourists to start coming back in droves as they were before the Arab Spring.
They may have found the legs of Nefertari.
I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, I think they found the bones of her, and they think that they could be her legs. I don't know where the rest of her might be, but, but that's what they found there. But, gosh, there's some wonderful things. I'm still curious about the Hall of Records that might be at the base of the Sphinx, as Edgar Cayce predicted.
So tantalizing. I had a great opportunity this fall to go over to the ARE for the first time and get to know some more about Edgar Cayce and his prophecies, his predictions, and all the insights that he had. And I was just absolutely blown away. In particular, I'm finishing a book right now about the Essenes and the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Essenes' belief that humans can transform into angels. And I was absolutely just blown away that Edgar Cayce, 11 years before the scrolls were discovered in 1947, he had already brought forward key details about the Essenes' beliefs that were absolutely validated by the scrolls. And there's no way that he could have known that the Essenes held these beliefs and these specific teachings unless he had access to memories of Essenes, or perhaps the Akashic Records, maybe even the Hall of Records. That's the only way he could have gotten this information, but he was absolutely spot on.
Before you came on, William, we were talking about Mars with Leonard David, who just wrote a book about Mars, and you've got some thoughts about Mars as well, don't you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I've just recently put up an article called The Mars Shot to Save Humanity, and I've been taking a look. I have a real interest in Mars because of ultimately the challenges that the human body faces if we're going to be able to be successful in colonizing Mars. NASA is up against a real wall in terms of shooting humans into space because, as I said a moment ago, the human body is designed to live on Earth.
That's right.
It is not designed for life in space. And so,
not at least for a long time, that's for sure.
Yeah, not in our present form. So when Elon Musk and others proposed that we want to become a multi-planetary society, as I look at this, it's very clear that Homo sapiens, the human body as we know it, is not going into space. The only way, and President Obama announced back in October that he'd like to see the Mars shot happen by the 2030s and that we have a colony on Mars. Elon Musk, SpaceX, Boeing, China, there's a race to get to Mars right now, but what nobody is talking about is how the human body has to change in order for us to be successful with the Mars shot or to colonize Mars. The only type of human body that's going to be able to be successful in space is a transhuman body, a cyborg. NASA has actually known this since 1962 and has secretly been working on it ever since then. And they just haven't gotten around to tell the rest of us that those who will colonize the solar system and become a multiplanetary society will not be human beings. They will be transhuman beings.
And now explain that for a second. What is a transhuman being?
A transhuman being is a human being who is part organic, part flesh and blood, part machine. In other words, a human being that has chips implanted, mm-hmm. that has synthetic organs specially designed for life in space, all the demands of gravity, of even of isolation, and all the other challenges that NASA is up against in terms of sending humans into space. They realize that the human body cannot make it in space. So we're going to have to change. The Apostle Paul talked about this in the book of Corinthians, too. He said, when we get out into God's many mansions, we're going to find many different life forms, a variety of beings, and even indicating that he had insight that when we go into space, we're going to be not in an earthly state. As Paul described it, we're going to be in a heavenly state. By that, he meant we're going to have bodies like the resurrected Jesus, a light body, or bodies like the angels, who also have light bodies, not machines. I mean, even the book of Hebrews, when there's the description of the celestial city, the New Jerusalem, or Zion as it's called, we're told it's inhabited by angels gathered in joyful assembly, and just humans made perfect. So they're talking about another class of human beings who are made perfect. They're different than you and I. And when you look up the definition of the word human being in Webster's dictionary, it says not animal or machine. So by definition, a human being is not a machine. A transhuman is part organic, part machine, and that is the type of being that will be able to colonize Mars and ultimately dwell in a multiplanetary society.
William, we're rapidly approaching, of course, the birth date of Jesus Christ, and you have done a lot of work in that area in terms of the Christ figure. Any more new research coming out to authenticate who this person was and some of the miracles that he apparently performed?
Well, absolutely, yeah, and that's the core of the work I've been doing on the Essenes and their couple centuries-long preparation for the arrival of the Christ figure and the preparation of Mary as a vessel capable of holding this child. The Essenes were part of a long tradition of spiritual elders, if you will, that sought to infuse humanity with a higher vibrational being, a new or next human that would show us the way towards our ultimate spiritual development. And that figure was Jesus. Now, a couple of things that are just blowing my mind right now, George, are centered on the Tomb of Christ story that's presently unfolding in Jerusalem.
Oh, that's exciting, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, Nat Geo going over there and opening that tomb for the first time in 500 years, and people describing electromagnetic disturbances and sweet aromas. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling that this is even happening at this time.
It's just amazing. I would love to go back to that time period, William, in a time machine.
Oh, definitely.
And witness
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what I wonder, you know, there's all these stories about the Knights Templar and the stone of the resurrection when Jesus resurrected and transformed into a light being, as evidenced by the Shroud of Turin. The Templars used to take linen strips that they wore around their waist, and they would actually charge them on the stone of resurrection, which is presently believed to be that stone that Nat Geo is working with right now in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or the Church of the Resurrection. And the Templars were told that this stone held a specific charge, if you will, or a frequency, a vibration, that would protect them in their earthly life and also assure safe passage into the afterlife. They didn't know anything more about that. The rank-and-file Templars just were obedient, and they wore these linen strips and never took them off. And then after the Templars lost control of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they started charging those linen strips on the Shroud of Turin, which the Templars possessed at that time. And it makes me wonder if maybe Nat Geo is somehow investigating some sort of a coded vibration, if you will, that is in that stone. And it makes me wonder what would happen if, for the first time in 2,000 years, they reunited that stone with the Shroud of Turin. Wonder what that would be like.
Wow, that would be an amazing story. All of this is just fantastic. Now, what do you think? Who do you think this individual was back 2,000 years ago?
Well, I'm convinced that based on my research, and again, I've spent the past 4 or 5 years accessing what the academics have been saying about the Essenes and about Jesus. And I know there's a lot of people out there that believe that Jesus was a hoax and we're worm food when we're dead, and the Shroud of Turin's a hoax too. But you have hundreds of academics with PhDs and everything from linguistics to archaeology that can attest to the reality and the veracity of the existence of this figure. So I'm going to go with the academics and not the naysayers, if you will. And then when we peel back the academic layer and we start looking at what the Essenes were trying to make happen. And again, the Essenes are Jewish mystics living in Alexandria, Egypt, and in and around Jerusalem. Formed 150 years before the appearance of Jesus, they are anticipating the arrival of a high celestial being, an advanced heavenly figure who will be coming to earth to teach humans how to transform themselves into celestial beings. This is one reason I believe the Dead Sea Scrolls have been sequestered. They're just too hot to handle. They talk about celestial cities, extraterrestrial beings, humans being taken up into the stars, portals, human transformation into celestial beings. All of this was just way too hot to handle in 1952 when they started bringing out these translations of the scrolls. I mean, this is the era of Ike fighting those godless commies. This is the era of Elvis. Heartbreak Hotel is the number one song when the scrolls are starting to come out. And you start to realize that what the Essenes were talking about is disclosure.
Hold on for a second, William. Let's pick that up when we come back. And also we'll take phone calls for the remaining hour with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM.